Royal Candidates. Politics thus resembled a game of musical chairs, with each successive reign reducing the number of players. Moreover, not everyone wanted to play, as personal interests and local concerns discouraged individual princes from standing. Only Bavaria remained from the original duchies by the 13th century as a substantial principality. Since 1180, it had been held by the Wittelsbachs, who originated from the Counts of Scheyern in the 11th century, and took their name from their new castle southwest of Pfaffenhofen in 1115. Their influence really began once they acquired the more prestigious County Palatine on the Rhine in 1214, and they saw themselves as the Staufer's natural successor after 1250. However, the family provides another illustration of how territorialization and dynasticism were not planned or desired historical outcomes. Bavaria was partitioned into upper and lower duchies in 1255 to accommodate two brothers as heirs. Both lines experienced further splits before a brief reunification from 1340 to 1349, with renewed partition only being resolved through a bloody inheritance dispute in 1504 to 1505. Bavaria and the Palatinate were held combined until 1317, when a separate Palatine-Wittelsbach line emerged, before itself splitting four ways in 1410. Further partitions followed a brief reunion between 1449 and 1470. Bavaria and the Palatinate were not recombined until 1779, with a final reunification of all other possessions taking a further 20 years. The Ascania also split, with individual branches offering candidates in royal elections. The Margrave of Brandenburg stood in 1257, followed by the Count of Anhalt in 1273. The division of the line ruling Saxony in 1288 into rival Wittenberg and Lauenburg branches frustrated the family's efforts to claim Thuringia and complicated royal elections, since both claimed the Saxon vote until this was definitively awarded to Wittenberg in 1356. With Wittelsbach and Ascania influence dissipated, only Bohemia and the Habsburgs appeared plausible candidates to succeed Richard of Cornwall in 1273. Bohemia was now by far the most prestigious territory in the empire, thanks to its royal title, relative size, and annual revenues of 100,000 silver marks, five times that enjoyed by the Duke of Bavaria. King Ottokar II voted twice in 1257, deliberately to force Richard to allow him to claim the vast Babenberg inheritance of Austria, Carinthia, Krain, and Styria, left vacant by that family's extinction in 1246. However, Ottokar's growing power alarmed the other electors, who chose Rudolf I of Habsburg instead in 1273. Rudolf I. Rudolf is often presented as attempting to reset the monarchy on a centralizing course by initiating a policy of revindication in December 1273. Named from the Latin verb revindicare, to demand back, this was intended to recover crown lands dissipated since the 1240s. The losses were indeed severe. Only a tenth of Mainz remained in royal hands, while the crown now only held rights over 1 in 10 towns, compared to 1 in 3 at the start of the 13th century. Rudolf had to compromise, allowing politically important princes to retain some areas they had acquired, though he often reworked the basis to weaken their absolute ownership. Overall, the results were impressive. Rudolf revived crown control over imperial church fiefs to 66% of the level under the Staufers, whilst recovering crown lands to 73% and Staufer family property to an impressive 68%, considering this had been almost completely lost. The bulk of Stauffer allodial possessions were thus added to the crown lands. Thanks to intervening economic development, the combined value of crown possessions was now higher than under the Stauffers. Rudolf's success further underscores the argument that the monarchy did not unduly suffer during the interregnum. The main changes included an end to the expansion of the crown lands and their concentration in southwest Germany, combined with a considerable contraction in Saxony and the Lower Rhine. Less obviously, management also changed in response to the continuing emancipation of the ministeriales as knights, as well as further immunities for royal monasteries. Some of these developments were long-term. Already in the 11th century, kings stopped drawing supplies from the economically weaker monasteries and instead granted these exemptions or assigned them to supplement the resources of larger abbeys or bishoprics. Meanwhile, obligations to provide food and accommodation for the royal entourage were increasingly converted into cash taxes from the early 12th century, well ahead of similar developments in France. Taxation was extended to royal towns that had developed on crown lands under the Stauffers. The obligation to feed and accommodate the king was frequently commuted into cash, but, unlike the situation in Italy, German royal towns remained more directly subordinate to the king. Rudolf also developed structures already initiated by Richard of Cornwall by establishing jurisdictions called bailiwicks, Landvogteien, to oversee the towns and recovered crown assets. Bailiffs were selected from loyal counts and knights, who were charged with safeguarding royal prerogatives and upholding peace within their jurisdictions. The network was renewed in 1292 and continued into the first half of the 14th century. However, it only encompassed the crown lands and not the immediate fiefs of the lay and spiritual princes, who remained subordinate to the king through the feudal hierarchy developed under the Stauffers. The bailiwicks reflected the geographic spread of royal influence by being concentrated in the south and west. Bohemia was temporarily compelled to return the former Stauffer crown land of Eger in 1276. But Rudolf encountered serious difficulties when he tried to recover Austria, Carinthia, Styria, Krain, and Thuringia on the grounds these were vacant imperial fiefs since the death of the last Babenberg, 1246, and Heinrich Rasper, 1247. Repeated efforts to obtain these fiefs were a central feature of imperial politics until finally abandoned in the mid-14th century. Virtually the entire north, constituting a third of the German kingdom, was distant from the king. Only 3% of Rudolf's charters were issued from locations in this area, while he never ventured further northwest than Aachen. The last royal visit to Goslar was in 1253. Political gravity shifted southwest, despite isolated later incidents like Charles IV's visit to Lübeck in 1375. The regions close to the king were now Swabia, Franconia, the Middle and Upper Rhineland, and parts of Thuringia. These provided most of the resources sustaining the monarchy into the early 14th century. The reliance of kings on these regions helped sustain the still large numbers of free minor lords, several of whom benefited from elevations in status, like the Zollerns, who became burgraves of the Nuremberg bailiwick and later rose to prominence as the Hohenzollerns. Not everyone was prepared to cooperate. The Württemberg counts showed how it was still possible to prosper despite generally refusing to serve the king. They rallied support in the southwest from those who saw Rudolf's plans as threatening the autonomy they had won since 1250. Count Eberhard I led a revolt in 1285-1287 that blocked Rudolf's attempts to re-establish the Duchy of Swabia. The bulk of the assets recovered through revindication were alienated again in the century following Rudolf's death in 1291. The form of alienation differed from that prior to 1273, because many were now pawned either for cash mortgages or under new service agreements, binding the mortgagee to provide support over long periods. Pawning became more common from the late 13th century, because mortgages circumvented canonical prohibitions on usury by transferring assets rather than contracting loans against interest. Only 13 imperial cities were never pawned between 1273 and 1438. Unlike transfer by gift or enfeoffment, the king retained the option of recovering the property by redeeming the mortgage. However, the mortgages were often so high as to make redemption unlikely. Louis IV mortgaged Eger for 20,000 pounds of silver in 1322 back to Bohemia, which retained it permanently. Eger is still today the westernmost point of the Czech Republic. Meanwhile, mortgages cut the king off from the real value of the land, since the mortgagee drew the revenue and other benefits in the meantime. Lucrative assets like Rhine tolls, mints, and ore and salt mining rights were repeatedly mortgaged until they were effectively permanently alienated. All this might suggest that Rudolf's reign indeed represents a lost opportunity to centralize. However, the bailiwicks never represented the basis for a new royal bureaucracy, but instead relied on using established prerogatives to entrust minor lords with supervision of royal assets. The dissipation of these assets through mortgages and other forms of alienation effectively removed the crown lands as a significant resource by the late 14th century. Rather than constituting decline, this instead reflected a fundamental shift in the basis of imperial rule to rest on the king's direct possession of immediate fiefs as hereditary family lands. This was already apparent under Rudolf. He owed his election to appearing less of a threat to princely liberties than Ottokar, because Rudolf only held modest possessions in Switzerland and on the Upper Rhine. These produced an annual revenue of just 7,000 pounds in silver, hence the revindication policy begun soon after his coronation. However, his use of the royal office to contest Ottokar's claims to the Babenberg inheritance proved far more significant in the longer term. Rudolf's methods also illustrate the potential of the new feudal structures developed under the Staufers. Rudolf held an assembly at Nuremberg in November 1274, when he confirmed the princes in possession of their immediate imperial fiefs. However, this act explicitly asserted the monarch as suzerain, requiring all to seek formal re-enfeoffment within a year, under the practice of Herren und Mannfall. Rudolf used Ottokar's failure to do this as an excuse to employ force to resolve the disputed Babenberg inheritance in his own favor after 1276. Rudolf's strategy entailed high risks, because few of the princes were prepared to see Ottokar fully divested of his lands. However, this problem was solved by Ottokar's death amidst defeat at Duenkut, northeast of Vienna, on the 26th of August 1278. The electors eventually agreed in 1282 that Rudolf could enfeoff his sons as Dukes of Austria and Styria. These acquisitions added 18,000 pounds of silver in annual revenue for the Habsburgs, compared to only 8,000 pounds now flowing from all the imperial cities after revindication. Rudolf's victory signaled the new direction, but not yet the definitive turning point. The leading princes still expected the king to live from what were increasingly termed the imperial lands, Reichsgut, and, for this reason, had backed revindication in principle, if not always in practice. They remained suspicious of a king who wanted to acquire too many large fiefs directly as family property, Hausgut. A transitional pattern set in for the next century. Kings continued to use imperial lands, though increasingly as objects to pawn. Meanwhile, they used their royal office to secure vacant fiefs for their immediate relations. Henry VII was able to enfeof his son Johann with Bohemia in 1310, while Louis IV gave Holland, Zeeland, and Hainault to his son Wilhelm in 1345. By keeping his gains split between his sons in 1282, Rudolf allayed the elector's fears that either would be too powerful. Unfortunately, two of his sons predeceased him, leaving only Albert as sole heir when Rudolf died in July 1291. Albert's curt manner further discouraged the electors, while he was simultaneously distracted by a revolt against Habsburg rule in Switzerland. Adolf and Albert. The electors eventually chose Count Adolf of Nassau as king in May 1292. Adolf's family was one of the success stories from the previous two centuries, having risen from bailiffs serving the Archbishop of Mainz. They amassed a large conglomerate of fiefs and jurisdictions on the Lower Rhine after 1080, securing comital rank when these were grouped into the new county of Nassau in 1160, permitting their emancipation from both Mainz and Trier overlordship. Like so many noble families in this period, their good fortune encouraged partitions after 1255, because their relative wealth allowed them to provide for more of their children through inheritance. Further partitions followed, and the Nassau lands were not reunited until the very different circumstances of 1814. Adolf was the weakest of the little kings. Again, circumstances played a role, because Archbishop Siegfried von Westerborg of Cologne wanted a pliant king to reverse his earlier defeat at Vöhringen in 1288. Adolf was obliged to grant Cologne and the other electors significant concessions, but otherwise continued Rudolf's revindication and bailiwick policy. Adolf used the windfall of English subsidies, intended to finance a joint war against France in 1294, to buy off claims to Thuringia and Meissen, enabling him temporarily to incorporate these into the imperial lands in 1296. This proved his undoing, because Bohemia, Saxony, and Brandenburg still coveted Thuringia, and now combined to oppose Adolf, winning support from Mainz and Austria, but not Trier. The dispute gathered momentum as Adolf refused to compromise. Mainz secured agreement from Saxony, Brandenburg, and the Count Palatine to depose Adolf on the 23rd of June 1298, in the first of what proved to be only two depositions undertaken exclusively by the electors without papal involvement. The action was highly controversial, because the legality of Adolf's election and coronation were uncontested, and it was hard to find a convincing argument against him. The situation demonstrated the relative strength of the monarchy as an institution, even if the current incumbent was weak. Moreover, the decision not to involve the papacy showed how the leading princes shared a sense of collective responsibility for the empire, despite their ulterior motives. It is likely that they already chose Albert of Austria as successor at this point, though details are sparse. Adolf was killed in the rout of his forces by Albert at Gölheim near Worms on the 2nd of July 1298. His death contributed to the lasting image of him as a failure, yet he had proved surprisingly successful, despite starting from an even weaker base than Rudolf. The outcome demonstrates the continued significance of agency in events. Things would have been quite different if Albert had died instead. Albert ascended the throne tainted by Adolf's death. A new election was staged in a deliberate show of unity and probity. Albert soon proved the electors' original fears from 1292 as correct, swiftly outwitting them to consolidate possession of Thuringia and moving to secure Bohemia, left vacant by the death of the last Premeslid in 1306. He was undone by his own family's lack of dynastic discipline when he was murdered on the 1st of May 1308 by his nephew Johann, who wanted a larger share of the spoils. Luxembourgs and Wittelsbachs. The Habsburgs again appeared too strong, and the electors rejected Albert's eldest son, Frederick the Fair, and instead chose the Count of Luxembourg as King Henry VII in 1308. The Luxembourgs' emergence broadly mirrored that of their Nassau neighbors, except that military defeat, rather than family partition, stalled an otherwise rapid rise to prominence. Luxembourg developed as a large county that eventually became detached from Lorraine by the 12th century. Attempts by the family to acquire the Duchy of Limburg in 1283 triggered the dispute that ended in Cologne's defeat at Voringen in 1288. Luxembourg backed the losing side and lost Limburg. However, Count Henry's brother Baldwin was Archbishop of Trier and persuaded his electoral colleagues to back Henry. Like Adolf, his initial weakness obliged Henry to make concessions at his accession. He is considered an unrealistic dreamer for being the first monarch since Frederick II to go to Rome and be crowned emperor. However, this move made perfect sense in helping to raise Henry's personal prestige over the other princes. He also continued the trend begun under Rudolf I by renouncing further attempts to incorporate Thuringia within the imperial lands. This brought the necessary support for Henry to escheat Bohemia as a vacant fief and transfer it to his son in 1310, laying the basis of future Luxembourg power, like Rudolf I's acquisition of Austria for the Habsburgs in 1278. Henry VII's unexpectedly early death from malaria in August 1313 necessitated what unintentionally proved the first double election since 1257. The incremental growth of hereditary fiefholding across the previous 40 years made the Luxembourgs and Habsburgs evenly matched front-runners. Hoping to break the deadlock, Johann of Bohemia's supporters agreed on the Wittelsbach Duke Louis of Upper Bavaria as a compromise candidate. However, Habsburg partisans preempted them by electing Frederick the Fair at Frankfurt on the 19th of October 1314. The Luxembourgs, camped at Sachsenhausen on the opposite side of the Main, belatedly proclaimed their candidate as Louis IV the next day. Frederick had been elected first, held the correct insignia, and was crowned by the Archbishop of Cologne, traditionally considered the right person to do so. However, Louis got to the right location at Aachen first, and was crowned by the Archbishop of Mainz with substitute insignia. These moves aptly symbolized the underlying political stalemate that opened the empire to renewed papal interference. Relatively low-level skirmishing shifted the balance gradually in Louis's favor after 1315, culminating in a convincing victory at Mühldorf on the Inn on the 28th of September 1322, when Frederick was captured. As in 1278 at Dürnkrut and 1298 at Gülheim, the empire's fate was decided in battle. Louis defused the dispute by recognizing Frederick as nominal co-king in 1325, the last time this arrangement was used. Louis also distributed some of the remaining South German imperial lands to Frederick's relations and allowed them to inherit Carinthia when this fell vacant in 1335. However, Johann of Bohemia now openly opposed Louis over conflicting claims to Brandenburg, which had fallen vacant on the extinction of the Ascania line there in 1320. A further dispute erupted over rival claims to the Tyrol in 1346. These problems illustrated both the growing importance of hereditary possessions in the competition for the monarchy and the dangers for kings who insisted on trying to claim vacant fiefs themselves, rather than standing above disputes as impartial judges. France and the papacy backed the Luxembourgs, while renewed excommunication weakened Louis's legitimacy. In April 1346, five of the seven electors chose Johann's son, Charles IV, as anti-king. Louis remained politically powerful, but died of a heart attack whilst hunting in October 1347. Shift of emphasis under Charles IV. Charles IV was an unscrupulous opportunist, dividing contemporary opinion as sharply as Frederick II had in his day. He skillfully held the political balance in the mid-14th century, managing to curb both Habsburg and Wittelsbach influence without driving either into open opposition. Wittelsbach's supporters belatedly elected Count Gunther von Schwarzenburg as anti-king in January 1349, but he was defeated at Eltville on the Rhine in the third case of the succession being decided in battle, and renounced his title on the 29th of May in return for an amnesty for his followers. Charles's confirmation of Wittelsbach's possession of Brandenburg reconciled the family to his rule, while their continued partitions hindered any real chance of challenging him later. Both Bavaria and Austria were excluded from the Electoral College when this was given definitive shape in the Golden Bull of 1356. The secular votes all went to Charles's close allies, including the Wittenberg Ascania, rather than the Lauenburg branch that had backed Schwarzenburg. However, Charles reconciled Austria by agreeing a hereditary pact in 1364 that eventually provided the basis for the Habsburgs to succeed the Luxembourgs in 1438. However, like Bavaria, in the meantime, convenient deaths and further family partitions prevented the Habsburgs from challenging Luxembourg rule. Charles's long reign, 1346 to 1378, allowed time to consolidate Luxembourg rule and to shift imperial governance decisively to its new basis in hereditary possessions, rather than the imperial lands and church. This was not obvious at the start of his reign, when he resumed the revindication policy with particular intensity to recover assets pawned by Louis IV, only to abandon it for good after 1371. Immediate circumstances provided one reason for this decision. Charles pawned four towns and associated lands, together forming what became known as the Upper Palatinate, to the Wittelsbachs in 1373, in return for their renunciation of claims to Brandenburg, allowing him finally to escheat this as a vacant fief that he granted to his second son, Sigismund. In this way, Charles swapped imperial land to expand his family's hereditary possessions. He then extended this to other imperial assets, raising 2 million florins, or 48% of all the cash he received from Germany during his reign. Although the money was useful, it was simply an added bonus from what was now a long-term strategy to wreck the traditional basis for imperial rule. By stripping the royal title of the means to sustain itself, Charles ensured that his family were the only viable candidates as kings, since only they now had the necessary resources. To this end, he also deliberately alienated the infrastructure built up since 1273 to administer imperial lands. The bailiff rights were pawned or sold to the counts exercising them. In one sense, this continued the Stauffer's policy of expanding the princely elite as a way of ensuring no single family had too much regional power. For example, the Nuremberg bailiwick was sold to that imperial city, but the criminal jurisdiction was detached and sold to the Hohenzollern burgraves, who were also raised to princely status by a special charter in 1363. The much-reduced imperial lands remained formally in being, though subsequent emperors accepted the de facto conversion of the earlier mortgages into outright sale. The remnants of the Alsatian, Ortenau, and Swabian bailiwicks eventually passed to the Habsburgs, leaving only three villages as free directly under the emperor. Old-style itinerant kingship was now clearly impossible. Meanwhile, Charles developed his family's lands to a far greater extent than any of his predecessors. Central to his policy was his family's possession of Bohemia since 1310, because this gave the Luxembourgs royal status, considerable resources, and a privileged position within the empire. Charles deliberately widened Bohemian autonomy, elevating Prague as a distinct archdiocese in 1344, underpinned by the construction of St. Vitus Cathedral after 1347 in the Gothic style. Having secured the German throne, he issued 12 charters in April 1348, confirming and extending Bohemian privileges, notably incorporation of the kingdom's various lands together under the Corona Bohemiae. This allowed Charles to break the practice pursued since Rudolf of partitioning family possessions to accommodate younger sons, and thus make the elder appear less threatening to the electors. Silesia, Lusatia, and Moravia were all fully integrated within Bohemia, rather than as separate imperial fiefs. Charles's younger brother Johann Heinrich and his third son Johann were given Moravia and Görlitz respectively in 1373, providing them with both status and resources, whilst keeping them under Bohemian overlordship. Brandenburg had to remain a separate imperial fief because it had been confirmed as an electorate in 1356 and was needed to maintain Luxembourg influence in the Electoral College. A separate Bohemian chancellery was established to free Charles from dependence on the imperial chancelleries associated with the ecclesiastical electors. Royal prerogatives were manipulated to redirect east-west trade away from the Danube to the Nuremberg-Prague-Pressburg route, benefiting Bohemia and undercutting his Habsburg rivals. Charles's measures had their limits. The Bohemian nobles defeated his attempt to revise their country's law code in 1355. However, his rule there was secure and enabled him to draw on considerable tax revenues. The empire's governance now finally came to rest in a truly magnificent capital. The 41,000 square meters Wenceslas Square was laid out to beautify Prague and promote the cult of Bohemia's patron saint. The new Charles Square was nearly twice as large, dwarfing anything else in the empire. Nuremberg's main square was only 8,500 square meters. The new Prague University, Central Europe's first, was also part of a deliberate attempt to establish the city as a truly European capital. The old relationship was now reversed. German princes were expected to come to his new court. The imperial insignia were gathered together in the new Karlstein, Charles's stone castle, built 30 kilometers from Prague between 1348 and 1365, further underlining how Bohemia was now intended as the basis for permanent Luxembourg imperial rule. The Golden Bull of 1356 fixed Bohemia as the senior secular electorate. Charles's two-year-old son Wenzel was crowned Bohemian king in 1363 as a preliminary step to securing his recognition as Charles's successor in the empire. The new title, King of the Romans, deliberately transformed the election from the choice of the German king to deciding the fate of the empire. This allowed Charles to overcome potential objections that Bohemia should be excluded from the Electoral College on the grounds it was not German. Wenzel's election in 1376 was the first time a successor had been chosen during an emperor's lifetime, since Conrad IV in 1237. Traditional practices were not abandoned entirely. Charles retained influence within the imperial church and continued cultivating contacts amongst counts and nobles in regions close to the king since the 1270s. These areas still provided 44% of royal servants, compared to 33% from his hereditary possessions, and they likewise received 38% of royal charters, compared to the 20% issued to his direct subjects. While Charles now had a fixed capital, he still spent long periods in Franconia, as well as making two extended tours of the western frontier, 1356-1365, and a prolonged progress across the empire as part of his state visit to France in 1377-1378. Governance of Imperial Italy. Charles also continued the modest revival of imperial governance in Italy, begun by Henry VII in 1311-1313, and Louis IV in 1327-1328, by undertaking his own Roman expeditions in 1354-1355 and 1368-1369. All three monarchs went primarily to be crowned emperor, but also to defend imperial prerogatives against papal and growing French influence. Their reception depended on circumstances, but only Henry encountered serious opposition. Despite local difficulties, Louis and Charles enjoyed greater support and benefited from the papacy's absence in Avignon, 1309-1377. Italians generally preferred the emperor as a more distant overlord to more immediate alternatives like the Pope or the Angevin kings of Naples. The situation had changed considerably since the late Stauffer era. The major Italian cities had mostly slipped from being republics to oligarchic regimes. These still sought confirmation of their autonomy, but their leaders now also wanted recognition as hereditary princes and were prepared to pay handsomely. The Visconti in Milan gave Charles 150,000 florins in return for recognition as imperial vicars in 1355, as well as contributing another 50,000 to his coronation expenses. Florence paid 100,000 florins that year and agreed an annual tax of 4,000 florins that it paid until 1378. Altogether, Charles received an average of 34,000 florins from Italy each year of his 32-year reign, constituting 21% of all the money he obtained from the empire. Charles sold confirmation of civic autonomy and other privileges, but he refrained from the wholesale alienation he practiced in Germany. Moreover, like his two predecessors, he was generally careful to distribute his favors fairly evenly. Charles gained prestige from making peace with the Visconti, rather than using force to secure Milan as the vital entry point into northern Italy. Wenzel continued his father's practice of rewarding the Visconti, who were elevated as Dukes of Milan in May 1395, repaying the favor 4 years later when they blocked Wenzel's rival, Ruprecht, from entering Italy. However, Charles balanced this by appointing the Counts of Savoy as general vicars in Italy in 1372 and integrating their possessions within Germany to secure an alternative route. Sigismund later conferred margravial rank on the Gonzaga, whom Louis had favored in the 1320s to secure access through their strategic town of Mantua. No Italian lord felt sufficiently confident to ignore the emperor, who might otherwise favor their local rival. Imperial displeasure could be expressed by placing a city under the ban that could legitimate attacks by its neighbors. Princely ranks bolstered urban despots against their internal opponents, while grants of vicars' powers enabled them to extend control over their city's hinterland. Although he did not appear often, nor bring many troops, the emperor remained the sole recognized fount of honors. Charles conferred knighthoods on 1,500 Italians at his coronation in 1355. Italian cities depended on imperial protection for their merchants trading north of the Alps. The emperor was still seen as someone who could resolve local problems. Genoa voluntarily relinquished autonomy and placed itself directly under imperial authority for 20 years after 1311 because self-rule no longer worked.